Investors Chronicle.
It's Thursday, the 23rd of February. We are here recording another Companies and Markets show. My co-host, John, has moved on to Past is New, but I, Dan Jones, Deputy Editor of the IC, am still here. And I'm joined by three guests this week. Over the line, we have Mark Robinson and Arthur Sants.
Good morning, Dan.
Morning.
Arthur, just about with us there, clearly. And and here in the studio, for the first time, we have Chris Akers. Chris, how are you?
Very well, Dan. Good to be here.
Yeah, travelling down from Scotland.
Not staying in a Premier Inn, as we'll discuss.
Yeah, well, exactly, because we are going to talk about hotels to begin with. But yeah, inconveniently for this segment, you're not staying in a hotel. But yes, it's a busy week this week with all manner of companies reporting, as you'd expect this time of year. We are going to start by looking at Intercontinental Hotels Group, which had its own results in the past few days. Chris, you covered them. All looking pretty good in terms of the figures themselves and the outlook. You know, IHG, after obviously a tough few years, is sounding quite chipper again.
It is, and that reflected, as I discussed in the piece, with management announcing a big new share buyback program, bumping up the dividend as well. So they are very bullish on this whole narrative about the return of leisure demand, hospitality demand, hotel demand, and that is reflected in the figures. I think the interesting thing with the results was the US performance. It's the key market for the company. It's where it has most of its rooms. It's the biggest revenue driver. And revenues in the US were up by 30% in the year. So the demand recovery looks strongest in the States. The company said back in October that business travel was back to pre-COVID levels. But I think the overall narrative across markets is that leisure travel started recovering first, with business and group travel then picking up as well. And I think, interestingly, the company said that they haven't seen any signs of consumers resisting price increases or leisure demand falling off. So it's definitely a bullish outlook from them.
Mm. Yeah, this kind of appetite for travel as part of the, you know, revenge spending, I suppose, as some people have started to call it, post-pandemic, where people still, you know, are very keen to, you know, have those holidays and enjoy them again, perhaps, you know, still full of a new appreciation for them. But the US market, as you say, is really crucial. And the US economy, as far as IHG reports it, seems to be going, you know, gangbusters. The prices are up and, you know, occupancy rates are very high. As you say, that even that business travel aspect, which maybe hasn't come out quite so quickly in some other markets, is still right there. So it's quite remarkable, really. I was staying in a US hotel at the end of last year, and I can tell you the prices are certainly a lot higher than they were a few years ago, even accounting for inflation and everything else. So that's clearly to IHG's advantage. One other aspect I wanted to talk about is China. Now, the company had invested heavily in its Chinese hotels back right before the pandemic, really. You know, it was talking about it at the end of 2019 as a big potential driver in future. Obviously, that quickly went awry. But with China's reopening now, that could be, there could be a lot of scope there for future growth as well.
Yeah, I mean, looking back now, it probably seems like terrible timing with all that investment right before COVID hit. And it's worth mentioning that China is the smallest division in terms of revenues, unsurprisingly, given how the government there has approached COVID lockdowns and zero COVID, etc. And sales in China fell by a quarter in the results in the year. It's quite hard to say, I think, how that will change this year in 2023. Analysts and management are saying it will be a relatively uninterrupted year, obviously, compared to the last couple of years. So given the investment the company has made in China, could see some big gains this year, I think.
Mm. I've been quite, personally speaking, you know, quite interested in the China reopening story. I think it could be a big change factor this year. Well, you know, that's not particularly a radical thing to say, but I suppose it will be intriguing to see whether Chinese growth does, you know, whether it is around the country or whether, again, as we've seen with ourselves and in Europe and the US, whether, Chinese residents are keen to get out the country and travel to other countries now that they can do so for the first time. So we'll be keeping an eye on that. One thing to say with the IHG, as with many leisure travel companies over the past few weeks, months, share price has already gone up a fair amount since the lows in September, October. So better to travel than arrive, I suppose you could say. You know, some of that is being priced in already.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that's something investors should bear in mind. And that's one reason we kept the recommendation on a hold for IHG.
Yeah.
The valuation. So the shares are rated below the five-year average, which is obviously attractive, but still trading at around 20 times forward earnings, which is pretty hefty. And yeah, as I argued in the piece, I think the more positive outlook for this year is probably reflected in the price as things stand.
Well, another hotel or hotel-focused company in which you are fairly positive is Whitbread, which we had as an idea a couple of weeks back in the magazine. Premier Inn owner, of course. And, you know, it's a different structure to IHG, which we can come on to in a moment as well, but also a different focus geographically in some ways. Premier Inn, obviously big in these parts. It has expansion plans as well, though, in the likes of Germany, and it's investing quite a lot as well. You know, got some quite big investment plans. Premier Inn does seem to be taking market share, but, you know, can Whitbread pull off these perhaps ambitious plans?
Yeah, I am quite bullish on this. So Premier Inn has raised its long-term room target in the UK and Ireland, which is its key market, up to 125,000 rooms, and that was up from 110,000 previously. As you mentioned, it's expanding in the German market as well, and that market is relatively fragmented, so there's a lot of potential there for the company to make some pretty serious gains and become a market leader. I think one reason why Whitbread's done so well is its pricing power. So management keep mentioning that the rest of the sector doing badly has actually benefited it, because you have other operators shutting their doors, closing sites, and Premier Inn is there to raise prices, and consumers are paying those prices, which goes along with its very strong brand equity.
Yeah, I guess, Premier Inn Whitbread would certainly like to say they're in a sweet spot where you benefit from the cost of living crisis because they're relatively keenly priced still, but at the same time, people are prepared to pay a little bit more because of the lack of competition. Perhaps also, you know, I mean, you know where you are with a Premier Inn, right, as well. There's that perhaps a degree of reassurance where, you know, you go to, you know, somewhere in the UK you haven't been before, if it's business travel even, or, you know, say a wedding, you know, some classic Premier Inn type stays, and you know what to expect. It's not like you book somewhere else and you might be disappointed. So perhaps that's a string to their bow as well.
I think that move into Germany is interesting as well, because I remember reading a while back some research which was saying that the German market, and I think the Italian market as well, there's a dearth of medium-sized, medium-price hotels in both those economies. And so that presents a real opportunity going forward.
Yeah, international expansion, you know, a big driver for Whitbread in the future, they hope, as with IHG. We should note the difference, or the distinct contrast in the business models as well, which you touched on in your Whitbread piece as well, Chris, in terms of they own quite a lot of freeholds, which is relatively rare, and they are relatively asset heavy in their business model compared with peers. IHG is completely at the other end of things, where it's all franchise based. You know, it's you know, no assets at all, effectively. There's room for both in the current environment, I suppose, where, you know, a tougher economic time doesn't necessarily preclude either an asset heavy or an asset light model, but it's something for investors to be aware of.
Yeah, I think that's right. So about half of the total Premier Inn estate is freehold. And management made the argument that this actually protects them from higher property costs and gives them lower earnings volatility during economic downturns. I think the analysts I spoke to for this piece seemed quite bullish as well on the asset-heavy model.
And on the franchise side, something else that attracted our attention this week, entirely unrelated in many ways, other than the fact that this company, Domino's, you know, is a famous company built around the franchise model, like IHG. Domino's Sydney. Now, you know, this is Sydney listed company. Domino's is one of those companies with listings all around the world with various franchises. There was quite a big warning there in terms of, you know, the company, the Australian listed company was saying, you know, we've put our prices up, but we're losing quite a lot of volume, quite a lot of customers as a result. Shares were down 25%. And in fact, that did send the UK listed equivalent shares down 5% earlier this week as well. Domino's PLC reports in a couple of weeks. So something to watch for there, whether that kind of trend does shift over to the UK as well, because we perhaps haven't seen so much as that as you might have expected, given the pressures consumers are under. But let's turn to something a little more cutting edge now for our second segment, semiconductors. This is a topic really to get your teeth into. There's so many facets to it. It's very interesting, I think, certainly from a journalistic point of view, hopefully from a reader and listener point of view as well. At the heart is the US-China trade war, which is really in many ways a chip war. It means you've got restrictions and subsidies being thrown around by nation states. Add to that, you've got the changing circumstances on the ground as we go from, you know, the high-profile chip shortage possibly to a glut, all in the context of an industry that is really vital to our collective futures and certainly our technological futures. So this is our cover story this week. And Arthur Sance, you have written the piece. Can we start with these? We'll get into the investment implications specifically in a minute, but can we start with some of these subsidies and restrictions being brought in specifically in the US? Its CHIPS Act has got a lot of attention since that was passed last year, trying to onshore production, trying to restrict what China can do and what companies, semiconductor companies, can do with China. You know, these are ambitious aims given how big some of these companies are and how embedded they all are in the global economy. Will it succeed in, you know, moving the dial much in terms of where manufacturing is based and how companies do business?
Hi, Dan. Yeah, thanks. So I guess a little bit of short-term history, put it into context. The sort of first major issue the US had with the Chinese chip industry came in 2019 with Huawei. And there was that fear in 2019 about China spying on us by installing all this 5G around the world through Huawei. And to curtail them, the US put sanctions on to prevent companies providing the chips and the equipment needed to make the chips for 5G technology. So there was a lot of success with that in 2019, and that was under Trump. But then we moved forward, and last year in October, Biden had a more widespread sanctions policy, which is basically now preventing any high-tech chips being exported to China, and it now includes ASML, which is the Dutch company that makes the lithography machines that are needed to make these chips. So all of this stuff is really essential to the Chinese chip industry, which doesn't have much domestic advanced manufacturing at all. And so those chips are stuff for like AI and like supercomputers and all the stuff that the Americans think are really strategically important. It wouldn't include sort of less important chips like a memory chip that go into your iPhone, for example, but it's focusing on the really high-end stuff. And then the other side of that is the Americans also want to, as well as curtailing the Chinese effort, which I think they will be quite successful at that, judging by what happened in 2019 and what I've read about the lack of sort of advanced manufacturing capability in China. I think that side of it will be very successful. The bit that's sort of more in the balance is whether America will be able to boost its own domestic chip manufacturing. They have the Chip and Science Act, which is, I think it's $52 billion worth of subsidies for companies that are building manufacturing capability in the US. TSMC, which is the Taiwan semiconductor manufacturing company, is building a $40 billion plant in Arizona. But words coming out of TSMC suggest that that's going to be much harder to make that plant near even close to how productive their plants in Taiwan are.
Yeah, obviously there's, you know, political incentives and certainly for them to make that plant, they're certainly being lent on as well somewhat, with the US also being quite concerned about the amount of manufacturing that goes on in Taiwan, given the geopolitical risks there. But Europe as well is looking at something similar, looking at its own CHIPS Act. Intel is another company which, as we discussed in the piece, has been left behind in some ways in recent years, and but they are looking to get in on some of these subsidies as well. So So there is going to be, you know, factories being built. I suppose it's just a question of, it's not just about the infrastructure, is it? It's about the, as you say, the manpower and the knowledge and the know-how as well, and whether those can be shifted across and translate and work in the same way as they have done in completely different parts of the world.
Yeah, the main issue that TSMC have, it seems, is with US labor and US regulation. So the US have tighter like health and safety regulation and lots of other regulations that make it a lot more expensive, but also the workers don't have the same expertise as the Taiwanese workers and have been using these like really high complicated machines for years. But also that some of the comments are sort of about how I guess the Taiwanese workers do exactly what they are told as soon as they're told it and have a better work ethic than their American colleagues. So not only the Americans want more money because they're more expensive workers, but they also seemingly are less effective workers as well, which isn't a great combination when it comes to making these chips. I've not heard as much about the European workers. I'm not sure where they fit on the sort of spectrum of Taiwanese workers to US workers and effectiveness.
Yeah, well, we could debate the various countries and national perhaps stereotypes and otherwise all day. But you're right. There was the, I think it was the New York Times piece recently, what was talking about some of the TSMC internal or perhaps unnamed people in the industry speculating about US workers' ability to match their Taiwanese counterparts. But you know, the proof will be in the pudding in that case. Let's talk about some investment implications as well, because as we said at the top, it's not just about the subsidies and onshoring. It's also that semiconductor story right now is also about the shortage, which we famously saw during the pandemic, perhaps turning 180 degrees into a bit of a glut. We've got a situation right now, obviously, where demand is falling somewhat due to economic circumstances. What are, you know, companies saying about this? How is this affecting the different companies in the sector?
It sort of depends on what the company is doing. So the chip industry is famously cyclical, like the oil industry, for example. When economies are doing well, people consume a lot more chips globally. And when things are going badly, they consume less chips. It's sort of been exaggerated this time around because there was that huge boom during the pandemic when people were stuck at home. So demand for personal computers and phones and consumer electronics went through the roof. So there was a huge spike in demand. And actually, when they said that there was a shortage of chips, they were making more chips than ever during COVID. They just weren't making as much as people wanted because the demand boom was so much. And then people built up their inventories loads. So these companies started building loads and loads of semiconductors because of this spike in demand. But then we had the inflation in 2022, consumers have squeezed. So there's now sort of, we have too many chips and not enough people to buy them. And you can sort of see that all the way through the supply chain. Apple said that Mac sales were down at 30% and their sort of iPhone sales were down 8%. And then Samsung, who make the memory chips for Apple, their results were really poor because obviously with less demand for the iPhones from the US consumers, there's less demand for the memory chips that go in them. The company that seems to be a bit more resilient, so those are consumer electronics and memory chips are particularly vulnerable. So that's Samsung in Korea. TSMC and Nvidia have been more durable because they produce logic chips, which are used for like high-end computing and the supercomputers that are currently being used a lot as the infrastructure in the AI wave that people are obsessing about. And investment in cloud computing, supercomputers is it's continued to grow even it's a slightly slower rate than it was, but growth in sort of computer infrastructure has continued. So actually Nvidia's results came out this morning and were good. The quarter-on-quarter data center revenue was up 6% and the quarter-on-quarter gaming revenue was up 19%. Admittedly, gaming revenue had fallen significantly in the first part of the year because it's a consumer business, but data center revenues at NVIDIA have just continued to go up and up and up as more and more of the big cloud computing players have been investing in computing. So it sort of depends on which part of the industry you are looking at.
Mm. Yeah, with NVIDIA, as you say, I mean, the stock has been on quite a tear since the AI boom, or anticipated AI boom, became something investors were focusing on. And yeah, I think up again another 9% overnight on the back of these results. Markets are always forward-looking, of course, as well. And we do touch on the piece, the fact that some analysts think now that actually a lot of the near-term pain is being discounted and you know, more the medium-term prospects are starting to be focused on again. That's certainly the case with AI. There's a lot of detail in the piece. There's also a very helpful glossary, if you will, of the leading players in the sector. It can sometimes be confusing, or to me perhaps, you know. It can be confusing to work out the difference between the manufacturers and the designers and the lithography manufacturers and what have you. So there's some useful information in there.
Yeah, on that point, Dan, I think for our listeners, it would be well worth their time to have a look at ASML Holdings that Arthur alluded to earlier on, because I think they're actually the market leader in this photo lithography technology as well. From what I read recently, they're about 5 to 10 years ahead of anyone else on the planet. And of course, it's that technology that manufactures the most advanced chips as well. So it's high. I think it may be the largest European tech stock by market cap. But people rarely talk about it. I think it was a joint university Dutch government spin-off a few years ago, and it's just developed into this this incredible market leader with... that's incredibly, also incredibly important from that geopolitical angle.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a company we discuss in a piece. And as you say, it's definitely a global leader, perhaps slightly unheralded. And that does also tie in with the European subsidies as well. You know, Europe is trying to get more chip manufacturing made on the continent. But some are saying, well, you know, you need to focus on the strengths. You've got a company like ASML here, you know, the lithography machines, which are, you know, etching the designs into chips are what you were really expert at, and you should be focusing on that. So there's all these kind of political considerations mixed in there as well. Speaking of which, I did want to just end on the UK. We do talk about some UK prospects too, specifically IQE, which is a company that has been in the headlines a little bit in recent weeks because it's been agitating, perhaps not unreasonably, given what's been going on in the US and Europe and what have you, for the UK government to come out with its long-awaited paper, as there are so many in so many sectors, a long-awaited semiconductor strategy, which has been promising since last autumn. IQE has been making noises about moving more production overseas. If there aren't, you know, support isn't forthcoming. Arthur, you visited actually the IQE hub, or the UK's semiconductor or chip hub, if you will, in Newport recently. What did you kind of learn from that visit?
Yeah, I went a few weeks ago. It was nice. It was the first time I'd visited one of the factories, which was cool. It sort of gave a bit more perspective to how everything works, and seeing that they have these like super clean rooms that you can't enter because you can't have any sort of dust or anything touching any of the wafers. So I wasn't actually allowed in there, but they let me look at it through a glass window. So their factory in Newport, it's a massive building, but then when you get inside, you realize that most of it's not currently being used. They have 10 machines in there, which they use to make their compound wafers. So a wafer is, they make the wafers will then get sent to the chip manufacturers, and the wafers will get chopped up into different chips. So actually the IQE is trying to find a way always to make as bigger wafers as possible, because then you can get as many chips out of them. They're a compound wafer company rather than a silicon wafer company, and they say they're the leader in the world at this. Probably outside of China, they are the leader. But compound wafers haven't been very popular up to this point because they're much more expensive than the traditional silicon wafers. The benefit of them, though, is they're more efficient, and they're used in a few sort of next generation technologies. The one that they are most excited about is 3D sensing, so it'd be useful in sort of virtual reality, but they're already in your iPhone, so when your iPhone senses your face, and also for electric vehicle charging, because they're more efficient, you would lose less energy when you're charging your car. And people didn't really care that much about energy efficiency before, when energy was really cheap, but obviously as energy gets more expensive, energy efficiency becomes more important. And even if the chip is more important, you might save enough money on the sort of efficiency side. So when your laptop charger gets warm, and if you touch it, that's because it's got a silicon chip in, and that energy coming off it is what's making the warmth. If it had a compound chip in it, your laptop charger wouldn't get warm. So IQ is hoping for these sort of secular, these trends to start creating some tailwinds for the company. And currently it has 10 machines in this building, but they said they had room for 90 more. So a massive increase in production if they can find the suppliers to sign the contracts with. And recently they have signed a few new contracts. They brought in a new CEO who used to work at GlobalFoundries and Qualcomm and has sort of contacts in California and Asia. And they're trying to sign some new contracts. And then once they've sort of got the demand in place, they'll then hopefully be able to start building out these machines in Newport. They've also got factories in America as well. And I guess that's where they are eager for the UK government to support them in building out and getting subsidies to build out in Newport. And if they don't get those subsidies, they said that they would presume they would build more of their capability in the US, and because just because it'd be so much more cost effective for them where the subsidies are significant compared to the UK.
Yeah, this Newport hub actually is notable as well for the company Newport Wafer Fab, which isn't listed, but whose acquisition by a Chinese company was blocked by the UK in November last year. So again, there's geopolitical concerns there, and clearly, you know, hopes from IQE for more investment. The final piece of the UK puzzle we should touch on is Arm Holdings, of course, which speculation about which has been fairly rife in recent months because it's going to list, looks like later this year, SoftBank is going to list it, probably in the US, but the UK has also been lobbying for a UK listing too, so we'll be keeping a close eye on that one as well. But we're going to turn to a different facet of the UK market to finish, which is something we have touched on in recent weeks and months and will probably continue to do so. It's takeovers and takeover activity. There's been, just in the last 24 hours, there's been more developments in the UK with Wood Group yesterday evening saying it has rejected 3 offers from Apollo. And the thing I was interested in, Mark, maybe we can bring you in on this, is the kind of offers we're seeing now. Now, we've spoken in the past about, you know, UK PLC being on sale for a certain extent, given relatively low valuations here in some sectors. And that is arguably being reflected in some of these takeover offers, not least because some of them seem relatively lowball, and some of them increasingly perhaps are getting bumped up, not necessarily to a great price, but certainly getting bumped up a little more by shareholders. I'm thinking of Dignity and Devro here in recent weeks. So, you know, what are your thoughts on that kind of dynamic?
Yeah, certainly. I think, I mean, what is a fair and reasonable price anyway? As you mentioned, UK stocks have become more attractive for overseas buyers because of the relative weakness of sterling. And even though FTSE 100 companies have enjoyed a pretty good 2022, they're still relatively cheap, both in relative standards and also by historical measure as well. So it's hardly surprising that we've got a few more entrants into the market there. It's interesting because foreign direct investment through much of last year suffered by comparison to the previous year or so. It picked up in the third quarter, but as part of that, M&A activity for foreign companies coming in and buying up UK companies, that rose to 25 billion during the third quarter of last year, and that's an increase of nearly 14 billion year on year. So it suggests that we're a sort of a low cost we're a low cost target for overseas buyers at the moment. And it's interesting, as you probably notice as well, that private equity still sort of constitute a large portion of those buyers.
Mm. And the other thing which our Bear Bull columnist has written on this week is that in the case of Dignity Endeavour, these were recommended offers as well that have been raised, you know, after being recommended, which is somewhat unusual and perhaps indicative that there is the opportunity to eke out a bit more for some of these deals if shareholders care to do so, which I'm sure they do in most cases. As I say, Wood Group, you know, those offers have been rejected, but there's probably the potential, well, there's certainly the not unreasonable sense now that Wood Group is in play, so that could be another company to keep tabs on very closely in the weeks ahead. But that does bring us to the end of today's show, though. So thank you to Mark, thank you to Arthur, thank you to Chris, and thank you to you for listening. We'll be back next week with another Companies and Markets show.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.